Ben of the Fisher Files, and this week we're going to talk about gadgets, technology to help you get where you want to go. So this week we're going to talk about gadgets, little bits of technology and software and things that can help you get organized and help you connect the large aims of your life with your 200 little daily tasks. Now, to start off with, I'm probably going to disappoint a lot of you. I'm not going to go and review all the cool stuff that's out there, because I feel, anytime I think about it, completely overwhelmed. And as an avid reader of Wired and Slashdot and things like that, I've seen a lot of interesting things, like the Avio pen system that was able to encode things as you wrote them and download them into a PC. I'm not sure if this ever made the market or succeeded. I haven't seen it for a while. But there are a lot of cool things out there. And the problem with them is, or not the problem, but the thing you have to think about with them is that they really have to integrate into a system. And the central part of the system is you. So no matter how cool it is, what you bring to the table is really central. Let me give you a little example. At various times I've had Palm Pilots and little notebooks and little pieces of paper I kept things on. And at a certain time I decided, oh, and a cell phone, of course, I decided, okay, I want to integrate this all together. And the solution to my problem is going to be to have one thing, and that's going to be a phone, do all the things a PDA does, have my calendar, have all my contacts, and all of that. And I wound up getting a Trio 650, which is a fine little machine, and it does all of that, sort of. So there were some problems. One thing I actually thought would be very, very important would be to be able to download my calendar and have it displayable on the web through MIT's calendar system, TechTime. That way Sheila, my AA, could have a look at it, and she'd know where I was and what I was doing and if I had an appointment open, because a big part of what I was doing was incorporating her more and more into my activities, which is something we'll talk about later. Immediately there was a problem, because I use a Macintosh, and the version of the software, the TechTime software that goes from the Trio to TechTime, didn't work with Trios. It would work with almost anything else, but didn't work with Trios. So wasted a couple of hours trying to find a workaround for that. Also, couldn't really get it working the way I wanted with, I guess it was iCal. I'm not sure what I was using at that point. So switched everything over to Palm Desktop, which wasn't so good either. And basically, when I first got it, burned a lot of time trying to get it to do what I wanted. And I also, about then, read David Allen's book, Getting Things Done, and then spent some time kind of stripping it around down. So I had my to-do lists on the Trio and calendar, etc. And for a long while there was using it to type memos and even some documents, you know, with my two thumbs, sitting on buses and things. So there was a while there when it kind of worked for me. But as I got busy and as I became less and less happy with Palm Desktop and tried to do other things. Basically now, the Trio is a phone. It's got my contacts in it, and I use it for taking pictures. I use it for recording sounds. And probably the most useful thing I ever got for it was a little Oxford English dictionary, so I can look up words. And I have also a PDF viewer, and I've got a bunch of poems on there. So anytime I'm sitting around waiting for something, I can drop into Leaves of Grass, you know, rather than reviewing my to-do list. The point of this is that you never know when you bring in a new piece of technology or a new piece of software to your life, really how it's going to work and how it's going to fit in. And I can say, I suppose I'm lucky that, you know, I didn't just discard the Trio altogether. Of course, I am eyeing the new Apple phone, which is due out in June, and you know, with great interest. But stepping back more broadly, when we think about the technology in our lives that's going to help us get organized and connect the large with the small, of course, the central thing in all of that is going to be your computer, which is most likely a laptop. Could be several computers. Could be several computers that operate disjointly or several computers that operate together. But kind of getting your desktop or laptop machine, the main one that you use, working the way you want is very, very important. And that's kind of the big message of this this week's podcast is any piece of technology you use can help you. However, you're going to have to be willing to do two things. Number one, invest the substantial time it takes to really learn how to use something. And that usually means reading the manual and spending some time actually playing with it and trying to get it to work. Many, many things are designed these days to just get turned on, and with intuitive interfaces, you can start figuring out what you want to do. But the problem is you'll run into roadblocks. You'll try to do something that you think you should be able to do and it won't work. And then you'll be stuck, and you could be stuck at an important time. And basically, whenever that happens, this thing that's supposed to be serving you is in fact taking away from what you want it to be doing. The second thing is you really have to let whatever technology is around that you're trying to incorporate evolve organically. And that means it may evolve in such a way that you can't use it, as my Trio sort of did. And you have to have the frame of mind that when you look at that thing, if it's still in your life, you're not going to think, "Ah, oh, damn, I wasted $500 on that, and look, it doesn't do what I want." You're really going to have to take the view of, well, that didn't work out. Maybe there's some other way I can use it, or I'm going to sell it, or I'm going to put it in this drawer and forget about it. Really, the bottom line is you have to go into this with the idea that these things are supposed to work for you, and in order for them to do that, you're going to have to learn about them. So going back to your computer, if you're really just kind of starting on this, one of the key things to do is to really learn how to use the sort of three basic elements of your computer, which are the mail program, the internet browser, and some utility for typing text. Which could be a simple text editor or Microsoft Word or LaTeX or whatever. But you need to find the basic utilities and really commit to them. So, for example, we talked about this before. Your mail should have a contact contact information at the bottom. You should know how to change the frequency with which mail is checked. You should know how to set up mailboxes. You should just spend some time knowing how to do this. I was quite shocked the other day when I was talking to one of my students during Junior Lab, and they didn't know about tabs on their internet browser, their web browser. Tabs are just alternate settings for the screen, or alternate addresses for the screen. So you can open up a new tab, go to another web page, and that's like real useful. Typical thing that happens to me is I'll find a journal article somewhere that has a volume number and a page number and an author name, and I'll want to go to that journal through libraries at MIT, and you know, having tabs makes it so I don't have to open two web browsers and switch back and forth. I can just open one and switch back and forth through the tabs. So learn how to use things like that. The Word program, whatever you use, you're going to, if you're an academic, and I would guess most of you are, you're going to need to know how to write simple reports. So you should set up a template for that. You should set up a template for writing letters. Also, your email program should have a template for writing automated responses. This is very, very useful, for example, if you're organizing a conference. So you should just invest the time learning how to do all of those things. Now, you should really go through your computer, and anything that doesn't work the way you want it to work for you, either fix it or get rid of it. And don't be afraid to get rid of something that has a great deal of perceived value. For example, in my office is sitting a big old Apple LaserJet printer. It's about, you know, it's probably about 10 years old. It's a high capacity, very high quality printer. I think, you know, Ting bought it at some point. It was probably $7,000-$8,000. And still works. I have it hooked up to my Windows machine, which is on my lab bench, but I probably haven't used that thing in 6 months. I can't remember the last time I used it. I think it still works. But I think tomorrow I'm just going to go and set it down out in the hallway and post a note to reuse, have some schmuck come and get it and take it away. Because it's not doing anything for me. So anything like that, even if you think it's valuable, if it's not doing anything for you, just get rid of it. Just get rid of, you know, all those things that aren't working the way you want. Especially true if you're having some kind of frustrating problem about your mail program not always connecting to the server, or your internet connection periodically drops out, or you have trouble printing, anything like that, any recurring frustration associated with your computer that happens on, you know, ever, you should get your IT person or get a manual or get a friend or get a new computer or something, but just get it fixed. You just don't have time for things not to work. So we've been talking a lot about calendars and context-sensitive to-do lists and waiting for lists and all of these things. And of course, that just cries out Palm Pilot. And Palm Pilots are good things. Particularly now, they're pretty high capacity. They're fairly small. You can have Bluetooth so that you can sync wirelessly. And you know, they're well worth the relatively modest investment. As I said before, though, when you get it, you should really sit down and read through the manual and really learn how it works before you invest a lot of time setting things up. You should really open a project, open a file, and sit down and make, you know, list of all the to-dos you want to have, all the different contexts, all the other files that you want to keep. I use the to-do list both for to-do lists and for waiting for ideas. Someday maybe I keep a list of books. I keep a list of movies that I haven't seen. I have a list called combinations, which are, passwords, locker combinations. And actually, that's one of the most valuable things I have in the Trio is just this long list of, websites that I have passwords on. So all of that can go into the Trio. However, for a very long time, probably about 15 years, all my passwords just resided on a little strip of paper that I kept folded up in my wallet that would occasionally sort of dissolve and fall apart and that I'd copy over. And frankly speaking, that worked about as well as keeping it in the Palm Pilot. So you might want to think about that. Just because you have a pilot, Palm Pilot doesn't mean that you can't have a little piece of paper. The other thing about a Palm Pilot is, at least to me, if you're going to really use it to keep track of things, you got to carry it around with you all the time, which means either you get one that fits in a pocket and carry it in your pocket, or you get the, dreaded belt holster and put it in there. Whichever you do, you have to understand that the only way these things make sense is if you have them all the time. If you're going to keep, combinations in there, it just doesn't do any good if you don't have it with you. As I mentioned before, one of the most valuable things about the Trio is the camera. And having a little camera around with you, either built into a phone or just a free camera, is really quite a boon, because if you have a camera with you, you wind up taking a lot of pictures and you wind up looking at a lot of things more closely. So it's probably not a bad idea to either invest in a phone with a camera or have just a little camera that you carry around. Another thing that I have that is actually kind of making an impact on my life is a Sony Reader PRS-300. So this is a thing, sells for $300, that displays text. And that's all it does. It'll display PDF or some book formats. You can change the size. It's got a screen that's probably 5 by 8 inches. And you can go to Sony website and download books that you pay for, or you can go to Gutenberg.org and download just about anything that's classic. And so the idea of this is that it replaces books. Now, I read quite a bit, and a few years ago my wife and I identified really the problem with books is not the money we spent on them, although that was substantial, but storing them and also just holding them. As I get older, I like to recline in a supine position while reading. And I was reading Team of Rivals, Doris Kearns' good one book. It weighs, a few pounds, and it's a trade paperback, so it's kind of ungangly. And it's really wasn't very comfortable reading. So I was about 100 pages in when I got the Sony Reader. So I downloaded Team of Rivals for $12. It's about maybe two-thirds what the book itself cost. I sold the book through Amazon for $10. And, I had a great time reading it. This little thing weighs, probably maybe a quarter pound. It's about the size of a large trade paperback and will hold, of course, an infinite number of novels. And it works just great. It uses this charge transfer system to make a display on the screen. And the screen, actually, they work kind of hard to make it look just like paper. The screen isn't backlit or anything, which would be convenient. But I think the Sony people in designing this adopted the idea that they want this thing to be as much like paper as possible. So they didn't put in backlighting or a few other features. So this is nice. This is really solving a problem for me because I have right now in there 10, 12 books of which I've read five or six, and they're not sitting in a stack anywhere, and they're not waiting to be sold on Amazon or carried down to a bookstore or something like that. They're just in my reader. Now, the reader is great. It is two more cables in my life because you have to have this USB cable to connect it to your desktop, and it only works with Windows, by the way. But you also need to keep it charged. And that's another thing with phones, iPods, cameras, computers, is you've got to keep them charged. And my philosophy is you always keep them fully charged. It just doesn't make any sense to have any of these things, anything less than fully charged. And of course, when you travel, I've frequently traveled with, carrying four different chargers. And again, when I get to the hotel room, I just plug them all in and charge them all up because I, can't count the number of times that, I've missed important phone calls because the phone wasn't fully charged. So again, when you have these things in your life, this is part of the, sort of the commitment, to the object. The other thing I have is, of course, an iPod, and in fact, that's what I'm yapping into at the moment. My iPod. Sheila bought me this nice Belkin stereo microphone interface and a stereo microphone. And so I have on my odd iPod podcasts, including my own, and a lot of music and a lot of pictures. And of all of these things, the iPod is probably the cleanest. Its use and functionality are very obvious, holds a charge well, and at least in my mind has been a pretty good addition to my suite of gadgetries. As someone who sort of follows technology and things, I don't think there's really anything out there that is so wonderful. I'm going to tell you, absolutely have to go and get it. The Palm Pilot or the Trio, the calendar and to-do list can all be replaced by index cards that you carry in your pocket, or a physical list that you write out, or by nothing, by just keeping track of this stuff on your computer. And you're really never too far away from your computer. So I'm really not going to say that a Palm Pilot is a must. Now the cell phone, of course, is, and you can scavenge a lot of time with your cell phone because you can use it to yap at people while you're waiting in line or someplace where you're not being too annoying. One thing your cell phone should have is a contact list that. Number one, you can sync up with a computer somewhere, and number two also has email addresses. Anything else on a phone is, to me, is just an extra, but it's got to have the contact list and email addresses. Otherwise, it's just really not doing its job. With all of these things, backups are important. If you develop for example, I use iCal. I now have probably 8 or 9,000 different items stored in iCal, and losing it would be just gigantic pain. Recreating it would easily cost a few days. So whatever you use, be sure that there is some backup program, preferably to an external disk. Or actually, ideally to a tape, preferably to an external disk, but at the very least to somewhere else on the computer. Now, the other part of technology is, of course, software. And there's plenty of that around. And again, I don't know enough to make a real survey. I can tell you the things I've found very useful, probably most useful, is the Oxford English Dictionary that's on my cell phone. It's useful in that, when somebody uses a word you don't know, you can look it up, which is a very valuable thing to do. You can while away quite a lot of times looking up words. It also helps your writing because if you have a dictionary readily available, yeah, I write things, freehand on a piece of paper and then give them to Sheila, who actually faxes them to someone else who types them up. So I'll be, sitting on a park bench somewhere, writing my DOE renewal, for example, and want to look up erstwhile or make sure that I get the difference between affect and effect right. And having a dictionary there is really valuable for that. I probably look at that 3, 4 times a day at the very least. Another piece of software I've found very valuable is mail templates. You can get these for any mail program. And what it is a little piece of code that sits inside your mail program, so that you can pre-write a message. And then when you want to send one, you can click on someone's name and drag it over to the template program, and it'll drop their name and contact information into the email. I've set it up so my emails, as I said last a few times ago, is my emails are like little letters. So it's, dear XYZ. For example, in junior lab, I tried to acknowledge the receipt of all the lab papers. So I have one template that says, dear XYZ, thank you for your paper. It will be graded, blah, 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 blah. And it just reduces that act of responding to, a few keystrokes. It's also very useful if you're organizing something like a conference where you're sending out bulletins or something like that. If you use a Mac, there is an extraordinarily valuable product called Quicksilver out there. You can download this from blacktree.com. It's free. And basically, it's a system for launching applications. But there's a deeper philosophy to it, which is its idea is it keeps your hand off the mouse. When you think about it, the mouse is a terribly inefficient thing in the sense that you spend a lot of time drilling through down through menus, and it changes all of that to, a physical activity. And so what Quicksilver does is put that all back in keystrokes. Again, it's a program that you want to invest some time in learning how to work. Mail programs, I'll just leave up to you. Now, there are a lot of organizationally targeted software packages, and the ones I've looked like are fine. Generally, they're centered around project management. And I use iCal for all my to-do lists and calendar and so on. So the things I tend to look at in productivity software are things for project planning and expansive thinking. I'll just mention a couple. There's a thing called Mind Mapper, which is for brainstorming. I ran the demo. I just didn't make much sense to me. I mean, of course, I didn't invest the 2 or 3 hours in learning to use it that I should have. There was another system called Omni Outliner, and on top of this, there were some guys who wrote a thing called Kinkless GTD. GTD is getting things done, and if you just Google Kinkless GTD, what it does is it kind of automates the whole relationship between project tasks and the to-do lists. So the way it works is you type project names at the highest outliner level, and then listed tasks below, and there's a slot where you actually, for each task, you can go, and there's a pull-down menu that allows you to specify the context, and then you can hit a button and it takes everything and puts the to-dos on the right context and clears off all of the completed tasks and so on. It seemed a bit buggy, but it seemed to work okay. It was kind of overkill because the way I do my projects is I just have a to-do that's in a to-do list called projects for each project, and I can open that up, and in iCal there's a place where you can type notes, and I just type, you know, lists of things to do and check them off by hand frequently during the weekly review. So, I mean, that's a little bit simpler, and you don't have to screw around with learning too much about how iCal works. But if you're so inclined, there's Kinkless GTD, and then there's another thing called Frictionless GTD that interfaces all of this with Quicksilver. So Quicksilver is really big for sort of Macintosh productivity types of the Merlin Mann school. Other software I have that I've found very, very useful is a package called Digizite, which enables you to pull points off of a graph or coordinates off of a picture. That's like $25, and you can find it just by Googling Digizite. One thing you'll want to do, if you haven't done it already, is find a good program for making drawings on your computer and learn how to use it and just stick with that. I have a colleague who has like 7 or 8 different drawing programs, and you know, this one does that better. And I think for most of the things you'll be doing in academia, Adobe Illustrator is just fine. You can find better things. You can find more complicated things, but Adobe Illustrator is really pretty simple and straightforward. Most of the other things I have are specialty. But what I've found that works well is to go through and identify a few packages that you can really use as cornerstones and learn how to use those really, really well. And, you know, don't get trapped in this, you know, 21st century, oh, I don't need to read the manual. Oh, I don't need to do anything. I'm just going to go in and blaze away. It's really a rather poor way about going about things. Much better to invest some time reading and understanding. So I'd love to hear from any of you who have found some technology that you really like. It's cool stuff, and I must confess, I do kind of enjoy messing around with new things. But you've got to keep a lid on it, and the things that you're gonna rely on in your daily life really have to be robust and well understood by you. I'm putting a link to a podcast by Merlin Mann about exactly this topic that I think makes a lot of sense. So be judicious in what you buy, and clean up your computer and make it like your living room, a pleasant place to sit and work. Mindfeed. One was a report on the BBC, and I'll put a link to the text version of the report on the program notes, about the city of Norilsk, which is a mining city above the Arctic Circle in Siberia. And the city is quite small. It's about 150,000 people, although it's the largest city north of the Arctic Circle. And the almost the exclusive product of Norilsk is palladium and nickel and a few other metals. But palladium is of special note because it's used in catalytic converters. Now, what catalytic converters actually do is convert greenhouse gases, mainly carbon and oxygen, into more benign products, and nitrogen-based gases into more benign things, and remove some of the carcinogenic materials from your exhaust. Catalytic converters don't work with leaded gasoline, apparently, and only unleaded. And they do this by catalyzing reduction and oxidation reactions on metals, and palladium is one of the primary metals that's used. So that's where about half the world's production of palladium goes into catalytic converters. And as you know, the function of a catalytic converter is to remove bad things from exhaust. As it turns out, the city of Norilsk is the largest single polluter on the planet. And the engineer who runs the plants said that there are 900,000 tons of sulfur dioxide, among other things, that go into the atmosphere each year from the smelting of palladium and other metals. So it would be kind of interesting to learn how much palladium goes into a catalytic converter, and how much palladium Norilsk makes, and how much stuff per car that a catalytic converter prevents from going into the atmosphere, and compare that to the 900,000 tons of sulfur dioxide. Now, of course, the sulfur dioxide is all produced somewhere else, some corner of Siberia, so it doesn't bother us or anyone outside of Norilsk. But Norilsk is in pretty bad shape. There's about a 20-mile dead zone around the city, and you can look at pictures of it. It's a law of unintended consequences, because I think when catalytic converters first came into use, they were a lot more expensive, and palladium was Norilsk was a closed city and in the Soviet Union, so we had to get palladium from somewhere else and pay for it. And probably those places were in the West and probably subject to some oversight, or at least more than Norilsk. And so this is kind of a feature of international capitalism, that what we're really doing with a catalytic converter, I think, is just exporting all of our pollution to Norilsk. And maybe that's the right thing to do. I don't know. The other big news this week was the announcement by Mini Boone that they had a result that was consistent with only three neutrinos. There was a lot of history to this experiment that goes back to the early 90s, when an experiment called LSND at Los Alamos came up with a rather startling result, which is that muon neutrinos oscillated to electron neutrinos and had a mass difference of about one electron volt, which was quite large. The mass differences measured in other experiments are very small, 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 5. Those are mass differences squared. This result really didn't fit with any of the other neutrino results, and in fact, to accommodate all of the results, one would have to change our picture of neutrinos quite considerably and add one or two more kinds of neutrinos. The other thing about the result from LSND was it was one of those things that was, let's say, presented badly. The collaboration was of the order of 20 people, and all but one of them signed a paper that was published in Physical Review Letters announcing this result. The other one of them, who was a graduate student at the time, produced a paper that said everything was consistent with no neutrino oscillations, and in a complete desertion of their editorial responsibility, Physical Review published both papers back to back. And this really lent an air of incredulity to that result. And since then, every discussion about the global picture of neutrino physics has begun with, well, assuming LSND isn't right, dot, dot, dot. The Mini-Boon experiment, which started about 10 years ago, sought to confirm or disprove this result. And this week they announced that they did not confirm the result, disproved it. They did so in rather a nice way. They did a blind analysis, which meant that the analysis team did not know what the result was until the very end. And so they set everything up, ran their simulations that was and selected the data without actually looking at the final data in the sensitive region, and also had two parallel analysis methods that cross-checked each other. They did everything properly. They specified which analysis method and which energy range their result would come from, and they were pretty leak-proof. There were, of course, plenty of rumors, but I think the collaboration had a pretty good record of keeping quiet about things. And so when the announcement was made, it was really very exciting. Their main result was a fit to the neutrino energy spectrum over the interval 475 to 3,000 million electron volts, and was very nicely consistent with the no oscillation hypothesis. They did measure about twice as many events in the region from 300 to 475 MeV, but their other analysis, which was optimized towards this region, was consistent with expectation of no oscillation. So I think they pretty much nailed it flat. I don't think there's really any much wiggle room. Probably there are some people who will run around and make a big deal out of the excess of events at low energies, but I think really the main result is that things are consistent with only three neutrinos. And so they're enjoying a nice week of attention and happiness at their result. The other thing that came out this week, or should have come out this week, was the results from Gravity Probe B. Gravity Probe B was it started about 40 years ago, 47 years ago, I think, to be exact, and has just kind of hung on. It's been nearly canceled many times. It's a technologically very difficult experiment that uses gyroscopes to aim a telescope at a guide star and then measure the precession due to the general relativistic magneto effect. As the satellite orbits Earth around Earth, carrying the gyroscopes and the telescope. And at this year's APS meeting, just today, in fact, the head of the experiment was going to announce the result, but instead gave a systematic error and explained that there was a effect that they were still trying to get rid of. So the saga continues. I hope they get a result out, and I hope the result is consistent with general relativity or cleanly inconsistent. But I do hope some clear result comes out because this has been a long, hard road, and it's really just time for this to be done with. So that it for this week. Next week, I'm going to talk about multitasking, when to do it, when not to do it, the difference between multitasking, time scavenging, wasting time, and being rude. So I'll go into all of that. And until then, I'd like to thank Sheila Marston and her husband John, and Sean Thompson and Maynard Galinas from the LNS Computational Facility, and Bonna Newman and Homer Reed from REFS. And I hope you have a good week and enjoy your work and research here in Cambridge or wherever you are. Be with you if you refuse to come with me. With you.